Second last person was this grandmother, the grandmother of the family, and her leg got stuck. So Ariel, her son, is trying to organize and manipulate that, eventually gets her out the window. She runs to get onto the solar panel, but Ariel never made it. At that point, the terrorists had taken over the house and they shot him and they discovered his body afterwards. But she could see one of the terrorists training his Kalashnikov on her and looking her directly in the face, and click, 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 the gun jammed. And she looked and she said, and I mean, we were there in the room with her, you know, listening to her saying this, and she said, "I had no fear. The savage didn't deserve my fear." Hi, my name is Anne McElhinney.
And I'm Philip McAleer.
Welcome to the Anne Film Scoop.
Yes, indeed. So we're still in Israel, a country in trauma, and rightly so. We are here to bring you the stories that the mainstream media would like you to forget, and we're going to bring them on. We're also going to be doing a special project in Israel, which we will tell you about at a future date. But it's an amazing experience to be here. We're very privileged to be here to tell you these stories. And our own little country, Ireland, is now well known. You know, where your little country, people don't know anything about it. Who's the prime minister? What's the capital? Our little country is now well known across Israel. Everyone knows.
Infamous.
And they even know who the prime minister is, but unfortunately for all the wrong reasons.
And how is the rest of the world responding to what's happening here and what happened here on October 7th? We will bring you some of the spectacular awfulness from across the world, which you need to ponder and cherish. And hold on to and keep a long memory of. We're going to bring you a number of those moments. And, you know, it's funny being here in Tel Aviv. At times, you know, you could almost be fooled that everything is normal, you know, lots of normality around. And then you'll suddenly see something. We're going to bring you a little bit of what people see that reminds them every moment and reminds us every moment, I should say, more particularly.
And more about Ireland. You might have seen something about riots in Dublin or something like that. You might have just seen that. But I'm sure you're getting very limited explanation as to what happened. We bring you the full story. And, of course, it's a story of rioting. It's a story of tragedy. But it's also a story of media malfeasance. And
hang on till the end, because believe it or not, we actually have a cat story, a big cat story. And if you hear any noise in the background, it's actually pouring rain at the moment in Tel Aviv. And we're in a room with a very specific kind of roof.
As we say, Israel is a country in trauma, but, you know.
Yeah, but in the middle of all of that, and we're talking to all these survivors and heroes of October 7th, but obviously, you know, priorities, you know, I needed to get my hair done. Women across the world will understand exactly what that means, that, you know, when there's an emergency of hair emergency, all things must stop for that. But it was interesting. So I went to a hairdressing salon here near the hotel we're staying in, and I was working on the computer, and so I was doing kind of emails and stuff and working out in the schedule. And then I can hear people they're all talking English, but, you know, heavily accented from all over the world. People, Israelis basically from all over the world, speaking in heavy accented English. But then I started hearing them saying about, you know, the British Prime Minister. What an awful thing to say. So then I had to interrupt them and say, no, actually, it wasn't Rishi Sunak. It was my Prime Minister, the Prime Minister of Ireland, the Taoiseach of Ireland, as he's called.
Leo Varadkar,
who had made this extraordinary statement at the weekend. At the news that Emily Hand had been finally...
So let's get the context. There was an Irish girl, Emily Hand, right?
Irish Israeli girl,
8-year-old girl. Her father actually was famous. At the time she went missing, he said... Well, or he thought she was dead. He was told she was dead. And he said, I'm almost glad she's dead, because being kidnapped is much more horrific, I think, by Hamas for an 8-year-old than the death. And then it emerged she was kidnapped. So he has been campaigning endlessly to get her released. She was released in the second tranche of hostage releases.
She had her 9th birthday in captivity.
And
as Philip said, her mother had died when she was very young. I think she was 2.5 when her mother died of cancer. Extraordinary. And the response from the Irish Prime Minister, the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, was...
This is his tweet.
He says, "This is a day of enormous joy and relief for Emily Hand and her family. An innocent child who was lost... has been found and returned, and we breathe a massive sigh of relief. Our prayers have been answered.
Lost.
Sounds to me like she was in a mall, or maybe she was walking in, garden. Like, or
she was on Rosnarla Beach getting a 99.
Or she was somewhere, like, you know, she was maybe in Disneyland or whatever.
And wandered off.
Wandered off, and finally they found her. Anyway, I think many of you have probably heard this story, and so the whole world have descended on Leo Varadkar, rightfully so. And I have to say, it's a credit to Elon Musk, the new Twitter, X as he's calling it, allows for readers' comments and allows for people to correct the records as people have written and said the terms lost.
These are the community notes.
In the community notes, the terms lost and found are misleading. You know, 8-year-old Emily was lost when she was kidnapped from a kibbutz, violently, you know, kidnapped, by the way, you know, actually very violently kidnapped. And she was found, inverted commas, 50 days later when she was exchanged for three Palestinian prisoners, three Palestinian terrorists. Mm. So I'm in this hairdressing salon, and what then quite quickly happened was everybody from with their curlers and everyone from all around, everyone else in the got up and came around, standing around me, basically delighted to hear that I wasn't impressed with Irish Prime Minister, because that's exactly what they were not impressed with. And it was kind of one of those kind of funny moments, but at the same time, I suppose Ireland has almost a distinction actually in its anti-Semitism.
Yes.
And we have a history of anti-Semitism. There were pogroms in Ireland when nobody was doing pogroms.
Well, I mean, the whole world, I suppose, had a history of anti-Semitism, but Ireland has excelled in recent years. Ireland is seen as the most pro-Palestinian, anti-Semitic country in Europe. And I think Leo Varadkar saying no, and I'm going to issue a bigger statement, and I was talking about lost in a biblical sense and all. Look, Leo knows, Leo has an election coming up, and Leo doesn't want to offend the progressive left in Ireland, who are very powerful, very strong, who control all the media.
And by the way, just you know, to give you just some kind of a scientific analysis of this, there was a vote in the Irish Parliament. There was a vote in the Irish Parliament to ask for the Israeli ambassador to be expelled, and it wasn't an overwhelming, yes, win for the people who wanted the Israeli ambassador to stay in place. So this is where, you know, this is what Ireland is, and this is what Leo Varadkar is probably trying to, you know, trying to nuance and trying to, you know, play down any.
Yes.
And of course, what he then did was, of course, because the whole world were shaming him, you know, he said, well, actually, that statement, you know, was part of a much larger statement.
No, it wasn't.
And it wasn't actually, but he's created this larger statement that makes it look like, you know, where he does acknowledge that Hamas had violently kidnapped this girl.
An eight-year-old child,
along with a bunch of other toddlers too, by the way.
Yes.
But
yes.
Anyway, that's one little piece of colour from here. But
so we've been interviewing survivors and victims
and heroes.
And heroes.
And heroes. So we went to Afakim, which is in the south, not far from the border with Gaza.
Yes, it's a little kibbutz or
it's a, well, it's a town. It's a town of about 30,000, and there was a very systematic effort on behalf of Hamas. They were going to go basically row by row of houses and kill people, and they were successful at the beginning. They, in fact, in the end, killed 48 civilians in the town. And we went there to talk to both survivors and heroes. And I think the first person we spoke to was a wonderful police officer who is filled with regret, by the way, that he couldn't have killed more terrorists or saved more people. I think he saved almost 30 people. I haven't done a count on it.
Yes.
more recently.
He called it the Day of Six Miracles.
And he had all these miracles. And he's one of these guys, really lovely personality, really lovely man. We met some of his family, his children, and he's very, very traumatized by what has happened. He killed two terrorists himself, and some of the stories that he told are just fantastic. And we're going to be continuing to talk to some of the people.
We're going back down to Afakim today
to talk to the people, some of the people that he saved.
Yes.
And we also met one of the people he saved. He saved a really large group, a family group who were hiding, and we spoke to the grandmother of that group. So she. And her family, she had Shabbat dinner the night before. Then in the morning, mm-hmm. the family were there, her two sons, Ariel and Guy. And she, basically the idea was they got this plan where they'd get out the top story window, the second floor window, and they would get over onto the neighbor's roof and hide under the solar panel. And so they got out, lots of them got out, and the children got out and they got under the solar panel. But the last, second last person was this grandmother, the grandmother of the family, and her leg got stuck. stuck. So Ariel, her son, is trying to organize and manipulate that, eventually gets her out the window. She runs to get onto the solar panel, but Ariel never, he never made it. At that point, the terrorists had taken over the house and they shot him and they discovered his body afterwards. But another thing that happened was while she was under, they were under the solar panel for hours and hours before they were rescued by the police officer that we spoke to, spoke about earlier. But at one point, she came out of the solar panel and she, nobody else could see anything else, but she could see. Suddenly, she saw one of the terrorists training his Kalashnikov on her and looking her directly in the face and click, 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 the gun jammed, the Kalashnikov jammed. And she looked and she said, and I mean, we were there in the room with her, you know, listening to her saying this, and she said, I had no fear. And I can tell you, this is not a woman who was making anything up. Everything she was saying was so extraordinary, the way that she delivered the story. But, you know, I had no fear. The savage didn't deserve my fear, is what she said. Amazing person. And obviously, you know, dealing with the loss of her son and to lose him in such an extraordinary, awful way. And imagine the knowledge of them all under the solar panel. I, of course, immediately went to the dark humor of the fact that there was the first time in history the solar panel was of any use to anybody
on the planet.
But she, you know, they were all underneath the solar panel. Can you imagine the wife of Ariel, who is under that, Shoshana, underneath that solar panel with the children, knowing that her husband and their father was gone.
Yeah, and then the children, little child whispering to the mother, "Mother, we should all pretend to be dead."
She said to the grandmother, the little child said to the grandmother, "Grandmother, we should all pretend to be dead." And actually that brings up another point that I thought was really extraordinary that we've been hearing a lot of, is that the children in these situations, in these horrible situations that were happening all over Israel at the same time on October 7th, children were really, really, really quiet. Babies were quiet. Extraordinary. And then somebody told us, we haven't had this, you know, verified, but apparently even dogs were quiet. That suddenly they had the sense of what was going on and they were really quiet.
Yeah.
But we also went then, Phelim, to the north to the beautiful area of Caesarea. I mean, gorgeous, obviously.
Yes.
Where they have these trauma centres.
Well, it's an event place. It's a hotel, a big hotel event place. And obviously there was the Nova Musical Festival. And I think everyone, you know, artists are trying to do art for people, but the music people got together and said, what can we do? So what they've done is they've taken over this event space. And if you are a survivor of the Nova Festival, there's 3,000 there, you can come there and meet fellow survivors and meet psychiatrists and therapists. And at the beginning, it was just a meeting place. Now they're doing art, they're doing some music, not some dancing, but they're gradually trying to make it a place.
And then you have all these really, really young people hanging out there trying to piece their lives back together and trying to work out what it was that they saw, what it was that they heard, what they saw in front of their eyes. And as I said, Phelim said, there are loads of people there to help them. And what's really interesting about this group, and you know, I think a lot of people have, you know, it's just an extraordinary thing to hear them, because these are young hippies. These are like the old style 70s hippies. They're like, they believe in love. They're all about peace. One of the first people we interviewed there, a young girl, she was one of the organizers of the festival. She was working with the production team, and her job was to go around and talk to people, the 3,000 people, you know, talk to them about global warming.
Yes.
And she was this very lovely, young, very, very extremely liberal girl talking all about love and we're all about peace. And she's now dealing with this new reality where the world she believed existed, this world, kind of utopia where we're all just loving on each other all the time. She's coming to terms with a completely new reality of what is actually true. Mm. One of the things that struck me about, and there's a number, we've had tons of stories, but one story about, one thing that struck me about this place that we went to, this incredible place, and we'll show you these pictures now. We could see when we went in there first that there was this, it looked to me like it was a place with secondhand clothing where obviously people maybe who were cold could get a coat. And I wandered up there afterwards and realized actually no, and there was therapists all around it. And basically it's a collection of belongings taken from the bodies of the people who had been murdered at the Nova Festival. And what they are doing there is allowing relatives and friends to come go through this stuff and find some mementos, some last connection to the people who they loved and who they lost. Also, you'll see now we're showing pictures there. They have pictures up all over the place of the people who were murdered, but also they have There are loads of artists here. Yeah. And you can see some of the beautiful art being made.
Some very dark art.
And some of very dark. But actually, Phelan, you know, and this is an amazing story. You see this picture of this man here who does look like the life and soul of the party. Yeah. 65-year-old Californian, Israeli-Californian, who I think, and people out there who maybe know this man can correct us, but I believe he owned a number of bagel stores in California. And at one point, I was outside interviewing somebody. Phelan was inside in the centre, and I think you taped this as well.
And you know, they played the speech that the girl, that the daughter gave at his funeral.
Of this man's.
His eulogy. He sounded like an amazing person. And then at the end, they played Frank Sinatra, "I Did It My Way," with pictures of his life. And you know, "My Way" is like a cliche. People roll their eyes at it, but never was a song written for such a man and for such a time as that, and people were just in buckets of tears. You know, it was a song perfectly chosen. It was a song perfectly illustrated, and it was a perfect life to show it. It was a life cut short at 65. He had so much more to give to the world, but as the lady said, the savages wouldn't allow that. That's why we're here, to show those lives, cut short.
And to kind of, and we're collecting these stories because this needs to be remembered. This needs to be some kind of permanent memorial in art. And that's, we're going to come more information on that coming up soon. But one of the things as well, you'll notice, and I'm again putting up pictures there, everyone on there had a wristband at the centre, and Phelan's still wearing his. And basically it says, we got a big picture of it up there on the screen now. We will dance again. And you can see it there also in neon lights that they had it. And this was an extraordinary place. We spoke to, I don't know how many people we ended up speaking to there, but their stories are extraordinary. And they're just these young, kind of hippy-dippy, peace-loving, global warming. They're worried about the planet. They're worried about global warming, you know. They're those kind of people, and they have confronted
They didn't know the existential crisis was a few miles away. You know,
and somebody else said that, these are exactly the kind of people who would have been, you know, going into Gaza, giving humanitarian aid and all kinds of things. These are the kind of people who would have been, you know, very supportive of Palestinians. But they have now, you know, come face-to-face with Hamas, with, you know, the face of... they've come face to face with people who want them annihilated from the river to the sea, and it's and they're you can imagine that they're really traumatized.
Yeah. So then another woman I interviewed, she told us about these that she could hear that one of her neighbors was the parents were murdered. They had 10-month-old twins, and the terrorists didn't kill the twins, which is unusual because they killed men, women and children. And the reason they didn't kill the twins was because the twins were crying and screaming, and people went to the house to help the twins, and they murdered the people that came into the house.
So they used the babies as bait to bring people out of the houses. And as I said before, a lot of, you know, we'd have all these reports of babies not making any noise, children not making any noise. That's when they were with their parents. That's when they were with their families. These two babies were left completely alone, and obviously were getting hungry. And it was an absolute plan to drag people out, because everyone was listening to the babies thinking, I'm going to go and help the babies.
Yes. And another family told us about spending 34 hours in a shelter. Their house was at the very center of the gun battles and at the fights and the first of all the center of murder, and then when the Israeli forces arrived, and they arrived in different waves, and some of them were wiped out immediately. It was the center of the war in their kibbutz. Their brother was murdered, but they were saying people had it much worse. They were telling me about one family who, as they were going into the shelter, the mother was shot dead, and they dragged the body in and closed the door, and they spent 32 hours in the shelter. So the father with his dead wife and his children as well, and his elderly parents, one of them with dementia, spent 32 hours in the shelter with the terrorists outside and with the dead body of his wife beside him.
And it's an interesting detail as well that people, the shelters were created as bomb shelters. So the doors to the shelters don't lock. And so you'll see and you'll hear probably a lot of people talking about holding the door. There's an enormous number of stories. Everyone basically has that, some version of that, of you had to hold the door. So they're holding the door for 30 hours because... because on the other side of the door, there's somebody trying to get in. We also spoke to a wonderful lady, and I had this conversation, by the way, in the hairdressing salon with the other people, where they talked about black humor, and they totally get it, and they're making their own jokes in the midst of this carnage. Mm-hmm. But there's also this resilience and this extraordinary spirit of these people. We interviewed this wonderful woman whose husband was murdered. He had left to go on a Jeep off-roading trip in the morning at around 6:30. She woke literally 15 minutes later to hear the sound. There was the noise, the static noise over the loudspeaker system in the kibbutz, saying
red alert,
we're under attack. So she got out of the bed, she got into the shelter. He phoned her. The husband phoned her
said,
"I'm coming. I'm going to come back. You know, because obviously we're under attack or whatever." But of course, he never made it back. But one of the things that she said, so she was alone. She spent 36 hours, I think, in total in the shelter, because she just didn't trust that they were gone. And she could hear this gunfire really close to where she was. But one of the things that I thought she said, and I've heard this more than once, and I thought it was just, again, the humanity of the situation. She thought, "I'm not going to let these savages shoot me dead without my underwear on." And so at one point she dashes out of the shelter to put on her bra and knickers because she doesn't want to be caught, you know, without being indecent.
If they're going to kill me, at least I'm going to be decent, you know.
So,
and then the other guy we were talking to, young man, 30-year-old, and they were trying to escape in the car. His best friend was driving. He got shot and the car stopped. He then climbed over, tried to revive his friend. It was no good. He reached down with his hand on the accelerator. The car took off, but it only got a few hundred feet before it flipped over a couple of times. Him and his other friend got out of the car. They were lying there pretending to be dead when the terrorists were shooting people all around them. The terrorists would leave and then would come back. So I think they left and came back three times. And when they were gone, they were doing last phone calls. They were phoning the people to say goodbye. And they phoned the parents, they phoned this person and that person. And then the guy says, he's going to phone that girl he's been in love with really for 30 years. He's going to phone her now. He's never told her he loved her. And he's going to phone her. And his friend wouldn't give him the phone. He says, "No, you can't do this. You can't have this the last thing. What if you die now? She's going to be having this phone call follow her for the rest of her life." And he's going, no, I have to tell her." So in the middle of this carnage, they're having this full-blown argument whilst also pretending to be dead about the rights and wrongs of phoning
someone to tell them that you love them.
You're a secret love, that you're their secret love. So I don't think he did phone her, actually, in the end. The friend wouldn't give him the phone. So that is the way. I mean, but there's so many stories. And we're collecting them all, and we're going to be telling them in a very interesting way.
And by the way, if you want to help us, obviously all of this is very expensive. You can send us a donation, a tax deductible donation, to unreportedstorysociety.com, unreportedstorysociety.com. We'd really appreciate that. Meanwhile, around the world, there has been the most extraordinary moments of extraordinary. People doing the journalism thing, or think they're doing the journalism thing. And what's extraordinary is the most veteran of these journalists are behaving in the worst possible way. And we're going to show a few clips of those. Some of you have seen some of these before, but they really are worth repeating. And the first one we're going to look at is Kay Burley from Sky News, who did this extraordinary interview with Elon Levy, who's one of the spokespeople for the Israeli government. And she says that she had spoken recently to a hostage negotiator concerning the rate of exchange. And she said, well, actually, you know what? Let's play it, actually. Let's just play
Watch the guy's face.
But watch the guy's face. There's some great body language here.
"I was speaking to a hostage negotiator this morning. He made the comparison between the 50 hostages that Hamas has promised to release, as opposed to the 150 prisoners that are Palestinians that Israel has said that it will release. And he made the comparison between the numbers and the fact that does Israel not think that Palestinian lives are valued as highly as Israeli lives?
That is an astonishing accusation. If we could release one prisoner for every one hostage, we would obviously do that. We're operating in horrific circumstances. We're not choosing to release these prisoners who have blood on their hands. We are talking about people who have been convicted of stabbing and shooting attacks. Notice the question of proportionality doesn't interest Palestinian supporters when they are able to get more of their prisoners out. But really, it is outrageous to suggest that the fact that we are willing to release prisoners who are convicted of terrorism offenses, more of them than we are getting our own innocent children back, somehow suggests that we don't care about Palestinian lives. Really, that's a disgusting accusation.
On top of everything else, what she said is completely illogical. But yeah, it's just, but I just have to say, Elon, I think it's become a gif on the internet that you can use his eye, you know, his eyes going crazy. One of the good things about this is it's made Kay Burley even more famous than she ever was before. 16 million people so far on Twitter have seen it. And I think it's probably on Instagram and everywhere else as well, and TikTok. So, let's make Kay Burley really, really famous. I think that's a great idea. The other piece that I want to bring you, which I think this really drove me completely batty, and I wonder if it'll drive you as batty as me. So it was a CNN interview, and it was an interview they were doing with the mother of a Palestinian prisoner who is going to be part of the exchange with the hostages, with the innocent hostages. Mm-hmm. So they do this interview. Nowhere in the interview do they mention why her daughter was in prison. Her daughter's in prison for trying to kill someone. She's trying to kill, an Israeli police officer.
Stab
him in the neck,
soldier,
I believe it was. You know, but that doesn't get mentioned at all. But that was one part of the thing that obviously is appalling. But I think on top of that, I want you to listen to the tone of voice and to the performance of the translator.
Yeah. Normally translators in
normally translator is just monotone, because basically, you know, obviously you're not going to try and, you know, you're not going to act. You're just going to translate. All we need is the words. Listen to this translator.
Oscar winning.
For the past 8 years, Sosin Bakir's daughter Mara has been held in an Israeli prison. She was just 16 when she was arrested.
Honestly, at the beginning, we thought it was a nightmare. Then it became necessary to stand strong on our feet because we have other children besides Mara. We have Musa, Noor, and Hala. Of course, the most important one right now is Mara, because after all, she is a child and she's so innocent.
She says that since Hamas's deadly attack on October 7th, Mara has been moved into solitary confinement and communication cut off.
We are really worried about Mara. The situation of the women prisoners is really hard. They confiscated all the electrical devices and clothes.
So there you have it. You know, nowhere in the clip and nowhere in the translation from the delightful Oscar-winning translator, who's really in the wrong profession, nowhere do you hear that her little darling is actually a terrorist. 16 is not, you know, 16, you know right and wrong, and you know what killing somebody is, and you're capable of it.
You know what taking a knife means.
And then the other piece we're going to bring you is the BBC, who are delighted with themselves and still not sorry for making huge errors. Let's play this one. And again, another veteran BBC reporter.
Missile hit the hospital not long after dark.
Ya Allah! Ya Allah! Ya Allah!
You can hear the impact.
I've got to ask you about the hospital. On the 17th of October. The BBC was criticised heavily for its reporting of that event. Tell us what happened that night and, you know, bluntly, where were you getting your information and do you regret anything that you said that night?
So it broke in, I suppose, mid-evening. And to answer your question, no, I don't regret one thing in my reporting, because I think I was measured throughout. I didn't race to judgment.
But you said that building had been flattened.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got that wrong, because I was looking at the pictures. And what I could see was a square that appeared to be flaming on all sides. And there was a, you know, sort of a void in the middle. And it was, I think it was a picture taken from a drone. And so, you know, we have to piece together what we see. And I thought well, that looks like the whole building's gone. And that was my conclusion from looking at the pictures, and I was wrong on that. But I don't feel particularly bad about that.
Not sorry. No, I'm not sorry at all. I got it completely wrong, and I'm not sorry.
Well, I probably led to riots. People could have died. I don't think anyone died in the riots that followed, but they could have. But I have no responsibility. I don't care. Why would I care? So, as you say, we're in Tel Aviv, and it seems to be normal life on the beach.
Yeah, I mean, look at some of this footage we just took, you know, and there's a busker, you know, singing John Legend, God Help Us.
You're crazy and I'm out of my mind.
Sorry for Israel in some ways.
But at each moment, you're brought back, always brought back to the reality, even though it looks like a beautiful beach resort, which I think we all want to come to. When things, if things ever go back to any kind of peaceful normality. But look at the end of the pier there. You can see at the very end of the pier, that's Jaffa Pier, I think it is. It's one of the oldest ports in the world. I think it's been operating for just only 7,000 years, apparently. Mm-hmm. And the words home written. And you see that all over the city. We see things, bring them home now, written on doorways all over the place. And obviously pictures of the hostages up, and they're not being ripped down in Tel Aviv, I can tell you. And there's electronic billboards, which are all over the place as well, you know, reminding of people of the fact that there are still over 200 hostages that have not been brought home. And then you think it all looks really normal. There's cafe life, there's people eating ice cream. And then you'll see some group of really young people, actually, beautifully dressed, very trendy dressed. But then you'll notice that they all have this one accessory that you don't normally see, which is a Kalashnikov.
Yes.
And what struck me, and I thought it's really amazing, because there's Kalashnikovs everywhere. You start to take them really, you know, for granted at this point, is no one is getting casually shot.
Mm-hmm.
No one is getting accidentally shot, despite the fact that there's guns all over the place. We don't even have to walk into our hotel, and I think I showed that to you last week. There's a makeshift memorial to one of the staff members here who was murdered at the Nova Festival. You know, we're in the conference room here in the hotel, and I asked them yesterday if we could have this room, and they said, yeah, as long as the IDF don't need it, as long as the army don't need it. And I was like, well, okay, I hear you, you know.
So I want to just do a quick thing. You may have seen the riots in Dublin. There were riots in Dublin. That was because, the story, what happened was there was a stabbing in Dublin city centre. Three children, one six-year-old is critically ill and their teacher was wounded. A police officer came out and said, I rule out terrorism right away, which is always a weird thing to say. It's a very weird thing to say. The guy was overpowered. Then there was all this speculation as to who it was. And, you know, stabbing children is not a very Irish hobby. Just like the guy who beheaded the two gay men in Sligo. It's not a very Irish thing to do that. And he was Middle Eastern. I think he was Iraqi.
We prefer glassing. What we do in Ireland, it's glassing. It's a cultural thing.
But we glass adults in pubs.
You break a pint glass and then you shove the broken end of the glass into the person's
face.
Everyone
needs a hobby.
It's called glassing.
Everyone needs a hobby. But and I think the media knew the identity of the stabber, but weren't telling it. So then Gripped, an alternative news site, Gripped.ie, run by John McGurk, who's been on the show, they had it from a very good source that the person who did the stabbing was Algerian. And they ran with this story. And this is significant because it's this stabbing of children, the stabbing of women like this, the random, it sounds like an act of terrorism. He was a Muslim. It sounded like an Islamic act of terrorism. Relevant information. Also, you got to remember that Ireland has been in the middle of an open border catastrophe where there's a housing crisis for Irish citizens. And they're getting hundreds of thousands of refugees, so-called refugees a year, hundreds. That includes 100,000 Ukrainians and then thousands a month of Jordanians, Syrians, Afghanis, Algerians. And Ireland is a small country and it doesn't have the accommodation. So there's been a lot of tension and there have been protests outside refugee centres. there's no, all the hotels are suddenly being taken over to house these people. It's destroying the tourist industry in small towns. It's got a catastrophic effect on the economy. So there's been a lot of tension and a lot of protests. And then when they realized this was a refugee, someone who had came here as a refugee, the city erupted and there were riots and they were burning. And the thugs then, of course, took advantage of that. And by the way, this is the BLM pattern. Only in BLM, it was perfectly okay. You were allowed to protest. It was actually a good thing to do. Even though the world was locked down, it was the public health officials said, no, in this case, it's not dangerous to be out in large crowds on this particular, you know. So the hypocrisy was appalling. This hypocrisy is awful. The media was holding back information. And when people knew they were holding back information, they knew why they were holding back information. So Dublin erupted, and Ireland's response to this is not to stop immigration, not to stop Islamic immigration, not to deport more people, not even to crack down on law and order and disorder in Dublin city centre and put thugs in prison. No, they have now decided what Ireland needs is hate speech laws. And there's going to be hate speech laws passing Ireland by Christmas. So the solution to all these problems is to trample on your freedoms.
And by the way, two or three days before this happened, Leo Varadkar, the same Leo Varadkar, that Leo Varadkar, just a number of days prior, had basically said Ireland is too white. The government is too white and we need to do something about that. It's because obviously there's something just wrong with being white. So you'd need to be, you know, and obviously because of this identity politics, everything that matters is what colour your skin is. Just a complete insult to, yeah, if you think of the great civil rights leader, Martin Luther King, who said, you know, you will not be judged by the colour of your skin, but by the content of your character. Yeah, well, I don't think I think Leo Varadkar actually hasn't heard that. Moving on, because we're coming to the end of the show. I just wanted to bring a few, because I think we did a little bit of levity maybe might be very important. Before we left Los Angeles, our cats were not happy about us leaving. And we're packing and have a look at what they did to my suitcase. And luckily, there's always the worry as well that they might leave a deposit there. They didn't anyway. But look at them protesting the fact that we were leaving. And then we come here, and just an interesting little factoid about Tel Aviv. There are an enormous number of stray cats here. Apparently, according to the last estimate, and obviously the people vary, there's about 100,000 stray cats.
And I think most of them are around our hotel.
We have now got to the stage. You have met us. We have got to the stage now of feeding them. I know. And thank you again for your support. We need you. And please do donate at unreportedstorysociety.com. We are going to do something very extraordinary with these stories that will make sure that despite all the very best efforts of all the worst people ever to try and erase what happened on October 7th, we will not forget. We will remember.
And we will make everyone else remember.
And we will make sure everyone else remembers. Okay, thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.